Tommy, I have a question.
Yes.
Well, actually, just a comment. I'd like you to kind of elaborate. You were talking about who is a Brahmin, and it reminded me of Swami Vivekananda's conversation with Chakravarti. Yes. And Vivekananda said there were many Brahmins in America that he had initiated. And Chakravarti said, how is that possible? There are Westerners. And Vivekananda said, Brahmins in terms of Brahminical qualities. Would you please explain just briefly how the caste system came into effect to enhance the civilization of India, and also what a real Brahmin is?
Yeah. Well, you know, during the early Vedic period, casteism was more or less, it was a kind of division of labor, division of activities. In the same family, there used to be Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. The question is about the origin and the evolution, the growth of the concept of casteism. Okay, now you find one of the important authentic statements comes in the Gita itself. Chaturvarnyam maya sishtam guna karma vibhagasya. So Lord Krishna makes his point. This Chaturvarnya, division of labor into Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sutra, it is based on guna and karma. Guna vibhagaha, karma vibhagascha, guna karma vibhaga. That's Shankaracharya's commentary. Based on our inherent characteristics and qualities, aptitudes, and behavior patterns, karma means. How our inherent characteristics express themselves in our external actions. So these two were the criteria for judging whether a person is a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra. But later on, what happened, you know, as it happens in many social institutions, this later on became a birth-based, hereditary social institution. It became rigid. During the Vedic times, it was very fluid, flexible. One could become a Brahmin by taking to meditation, contemplation, study of the Vedas, and so on. One could become a Kshatriya by joining the army, kings, retainers, and so on. But later on, what happened, you know, according to many anthropologists and sociologists, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas together, the kings and the priests together, made it a more rigid institution based on birth. So it became very rigid. This must have happened during the Smriti period. So there is a gap of at least 2,000 years between the early Vedic period and the period of Smritis. Smritis means the constitutions, the codes of law. The earliest lawgiver was Manu, who belongs to around 1900 BC. So, it is a slow evolution from a highly flexible, a fluid social institution into highly inflexible, rigid, birth-based institution. So, that's how it became what we call casteism as we understand it today. When Swamiji spoke about spiritual qualities of people all over the world, he said there are great spiritual seekers all over the world. And those who have a natural inherent tendency for spiritual life could be called Brahmins. So Swamiji met many such people. Not only in India, but all over the world, he found. So that's what he said actually. So they were very, very great spiritual seekers, strong spiritual inclination in America and Europe, not only in India, but all over the world, Swamiji found. So he was talking about Brahmins in the in the real spiritual sense of the term. I mean those who are spiritually inclined at Brahmins. Now in the Upanishad that I recited this morning, normally in those days during the Vedic times, those who are spiritually inclined used to study the Vedas and practice this fire sacrifice. You have to remember, during the Vedic times there were no temples as such. The widespread practice of image worship also was not prevalent during the early Vedic period. The great sages and sages used to teach, instruct their disciples to meditate. Different forms of upasanas and vidyas you find in the Upanishad literature. You find Dahara Vidya, Varumi Vidya and Punjabi Vidya. Different, these vidyas were upasana methods. Different forms of meditation accompanied by some rituals. And while instructing the disciples, the teachers used to take parables and illustrations from nature. So you find valleys, mountains, rivers, oceans, clouds, sky, all these are taken as illustrations in the Vedic literature. So those who are inclined to spiritual life were called Brahmins in the true sense of the term during the early time. That was the meaning Swamiji had in mind when he used that term. So later on, it became a rigid process. This always happened. See, can you reconcile the fundamental principles of American Constitution with slavery? Even after the Declaration of Independence, American Constitution was established, slavery continued in this country. Can you reconcile the teachings of Jesus with the Inquisition or Crusades? Appeared. Similarly, in Hinduism also, in spite of the great Vedanta teachings, the casteism and all the social injustices prevailed. Later on, they crept into society. If you look at the Soviet Union's history, fine. If you read the early teachings of Trotsky, Kerensky and Lenin, you have many wonderful teachings of humanistic ideas. Not political ideas I'm talking about. The equal rights, the proletariat, and the equal opportunities for the whole state. But later on, there were special schools, colleges, and townships for the members of the Soviet precision. Not only members of the cardboard members of the Soviet Communist Party alone could send their children to those schools, could stay in those townships. So you often find this happening all over the world history. What emerges as a highly flexible, humanistic, rational, social practice later on become a very rigid, inflexible custom, hereditary custom. This happened all over the world. Everywhere you find this. There is, some people want to make these special rights their own privileges. Slowly it becomes a monopolization of rights and privileges. It happens. Everywhere it happens. That's the fate of all prophets and spiritual teachers. Whatever they teach in the beginning, slowly gets diluted and they change. Forms,
right? The other day you were talking about Schopenhauer and the effect that the Vedas had on I've looked at Schopenhauer, considered reading him, but I've always been put off by his reputation for being a very pessimistic philosopher. He has that reputation. How can he have that reputation?
Yeah. Maybe that pessimism made him all the more a great devotee of Upanishad literature. Because you find that's what made him a great devotee of Upanishad literature. So when he read this Latin translation of a patient translation of the Upanishads, patient translation was done in 1566-67 when Emperor Akbar was the Indian emperor. Now when he read these Upanishads, he suddenly came across his religious philosophy which is so different from the conventional religious theological systems that he was familiar with. Most of the pessimism was as a kind of revolt against the tyranny of theology that continued in Europe for long centuries, right from Augustine onwards. Yeah, theology became a tyrant. So there was always a conflict between theology, philosophy and mysticism. Philosophy itself became an independent prisoner in the hands of theology. No independent thought could grow till the emergence of British empiricism in England and Kant in Germany. So that's what really happened, you know. So anything that doesn't fully agree with the biblical, the established ecclesiastical teachings, theological teachings, was rejected, and very, very often they were persecuted, including scientists, Galileo, Copernicus, Lord. So I think maybe Schopenhauer belonged to an era when Europe was slowly waking up. Kant gave a great fillip to this modern thinking all over Europe. So that's the thing. Yes. Yes.
In the Advaita philosophy, body is form, it's a traditional form, it's the realization of the Atma.
Can you speak up?
In the Advaita philosophy, body is formless, right, it's realization of the Atma. But in the Vaishnava tradition, body is a form. How do we reconcile those two things? So the body is formless and body is a form.
Yes, in Advaita philosophy,
you
say.
Yes,
I'm repeating. You said in Advaita philosophy, God is formless, and in some other systems, God is with form. How do you reconcile? Well, Advaita does not reject the idea of God with form. It only says that as you evolve, then your idea of God goes beyond the idea of God with form, but doesn't contradict or reject the idea of God with form. So, in spiritual life, we all start with Dvaita. And we go through the stage of Vishishta Advaita and reach Advaita. So, Advaita includes, it accommodates all other systems of religious philosophy. So it is an all-inclusive one, not all-exclusive one, in the sense Advaitins themselves never say that any system is wrong. In actual spiritual practice, you know, as we evolve, our idea of God also evolves, in direct proportion to our own evolution. In the beginning you may think God is different. According to Madhya system, the Pancha Veda Siddhanta, if you can think of a triangle, God on the top, on left side there is world, Jagat, on the right side Jiva or human beings. There's a difference between God and the universe, and God and different human beings, and there's a difference between the universe and different human beings. There's a difference among different human beings. There is also a difference among different entities in this world. The Panchabheda. Everything is different from everything else. This is the most elementary form of plurality, dualism. Now Ramanuja says there's a Visishtadvaita. Visishtam is Visishtadvaita. So, God God leaves us antaryami in everything. And the whole thing is within God. So, in the sense that we do not have an independent existence, independent entity, other than distinct from God. We cannot be completely distinct from God. Because God lives as antaryami within all of us. But we are not the same as God. So there is an element of identity and also difference in Ramananda's system. And the universe and jivas also evolved, they are evolutes of God. So there is an element of identity and also an element of distinction in Ramananda's system. In Vedanta, when you realize the highest spiritual truth, going through different processes, you finally realize that the Atman, the God whom you are seeking, is actually within yourself. But not as a physical body. I can explain this in the light of the Tattvamasi Mahavakyam that I explained, that I took up. I didn't get time to explain the philosophical foundation of it. Tattvamasi Vakyam is explained in this way. Vachyartha Lakshyartha means the literal meaning and also the real implied meaning. We take the implied meaning, not literal meaning. Literally, Tattvamasi, Tat is Ishvara, a monotheistic God who creates this world. Tvam is Jivas, this human body, it all is Jivas, different beings. Asi is the same, its identity, Tadatmya, is expressed. Now, this creator God cannot be you and me and all this. Cannot be. So, Vachyartham, a literal meaning, is not accepted, is rejected. What's the implied meaning? Okay, now, if you take the implied Lakshyartham, Tvam is not this physical embodiment, but the Kodastha Chaitanyam it is called. It is that Chaitanyam, the consciousness, the divine principle that lives within this psychophysical mechanism. Not the psychophysical mechanism itself. It is an embodiment. But within this psychophysical mechanism, there is a Kodastha Chaitanyam. That is the Lakshyartham of Tvam. Tat is not the created God, but the world itself is not an absolute reality. It is only a relative entity. So you cannot accept a created God as absolute reality if you accept the creation itself as something relative. It's non-absolute. So what is the Lakshyartham of Tat? It is Satchidananda Brahman itself, the impersonal, attributeless, eternal, non-dual principle. That's the Lakshyartham of Tat. So, in Advaita, if you look upon yourself as devoid of or different from this embodiment, this 6 feet human body with the mind which feels pain and pleasure, which is happy and unhappy, which eats food and drinks water. If you remove this psychophysical aspect and take only the inherent, the inner principle, the immanent principle, that is Kodastha Chaitanyam. And that Kodastha Chaitanyam is the same as the all-pervading, the eternal Brahman. That is the real implication of Tattvamasi. So Advaita, in short, does not reject any non-Advaitic views or attitudes. It only transcends it. That's an important point. The idea of if A is right, then B should be wrong is essentially a theological concept. It is not applicable in Vedantic concept. Vedanta, you can be right, the other person also can be right. But you may be right, but your vision of the reality may be incomplete. The other person's vision of reality may be little less incomplete in the sense it is more complete. That's all. Advaita is the total view of the absolute reality. Other views are right, but they are only partially right. There is no rejection at all in Advaita. That's why in the Mandukya area there is a famous statement, Susiddhanta Vavasthasu Dvaitino Nishchita Dhidham Parasparam Virudhyante Taihi Ayamna Virudhide. In the Mandukya Kariya, Gotapada Kariya, there is a statement, Susiddhanta Vavasthasu. Now, what happens, you know, if you are a dualist, then you think if A is right, then everything else might be wrong. Dvaita view. In Advaita view, A is right, that doesn't mean that B should be wrong. That's wrong. That's not correct. B should be another aspect of A. That's all. So, we evolve from Dvaita to Vishishta Advaita and finally to Sadvaita. That is Advaita view. There is no rejection. There is no conflict. That's an important aspect. It was this that impressed men like Schopenhauer. Because the traditional theology, everything is said be right or wrong. You are wrong, the other man is right. So it should be rejected. But Vedanta doesn't say that. That's the idea behind it. Vedanta will tell you that even not a person who does not believe in God can be spiritual. Vedanta alone can tell you. You need not believe in God. He can be Vedanta. See, Buddha. Buddha didn't believe in a creator God. He is considered to be one of the greatest spiritual teachers. In traditional Hinduism, he is elevated as one of the incarnations. That's why Swami Vivekananda makes an interesting statement based on this principle. He says, in one of his lectures in London, he said that if you live your life in such a way that God will accept you even if you do not accept Him. So if an atheist, an agnostic is leading an ideal life, he's very humane, very compassionate, he can be spiritual. That's why, you know, Gandhi, for example, Gandhi very rarely went to temple and prayed. He visited many temples. In one of the famous temples, Vaikom Satyagraha, he worked hard to make the temple accessible to lower caste people. He was a great social reformer, but he himself never went to the temple and worshipped. And he is considered to be one of the great Hindus. So there is something very broad-minded, very universal in Vedanta. Everyone can be Vedanti. Without rejecting his own view, without converting, without transferring himself from one tradition to another tradition. You can be Vedanti if you recognize the universal teachings of Jesus, universal teachings of Buddha, or anybody for that matter. That's the idea. Which you want to transfer.
Yeah, because Thakur is Thakur, he's beyond our conception, but he was a theologist also, right? Because he worshipped Mahakali. And he was a big Vedanta.
Yeah. You know, the greatest Advaita philosopher Shankaracharya is the author of the most sublime Sanskrit devotional hymns.
Yes.
Most sublime, beautiful hymns on Mother, Subramanya, Shiva, Krishna, all written by Shankaracharya. Sri Ramakrishna was a supreme exponent of Advaita. Yeah. But every moment he was a devotee of God.
Yeah.
That's why the idea that if you are an Advaitin, then you should not go to temple, you should reject everything else. That's a totally wrong concept. If A is right, then B should be wrong. Is not applicable in Vedanta. It is a purely dualistic attitude, dualistic approach. If A is right, then B also can be right, from another angle. So, this Sarvadharma Samanaya idea, its philosophical foundation is Advaita. His metaphysical foundations are to it.
Swami, what was so interesting in the story you brought out, Sri Ramakrishna used that story, he changed it, the three robbers. And so often his parables, they have a source that go back to the Upanishads.
Yeah.
Would you like to comment on that? He did change it a little bit.
No, these parables are taken in different ways and expressed. See, that's true. What Sri Ramakrishna is referring to, you know, the robbers cannot go to... in fact, that story, you know, the robbers, the Satriga, Rajasiga, Tamasiga robbers, that story is not related to this.
Really?
Here, these stories, these robbers are real cutthroat crooks. unlike Sri Ramakrishna, in Sri Ramakrishna's story, there is a wonderful robber, a Satric person,
yes,
who unties the ropes and takes the person. But he cannot then become a policeman to catch him. Because
is there a source to that story? Or
he made it. Sometimes, you know, people used to visit Dakshineswar temple and they used to tell different stories. So Sri Ramakrishna got all these from so many sources. Whatever he heard, he never forgot. So in this story, the one who unties the rope and liberates the person from bondage is a real spiritual teacher, instructor, not a robber. The robbers leave him there and they are not Sattvika, it's no distinction. Yes. Those robbers don't come back again to liberate him. They have gone there, they may be in prison.
I was just curious where the source came from.
No, this maybe many such stories are found in popular usage, you know, conventional usage. But in the Upanishad passage, those robbers just left him in the forest and went away. They did not return. And it is a spiritual teacher, the Acharya, mentioned here. You know, in the previous illustration, Uddharaga asked Vedaketu to bring a lump of sugar and put it in water, and then asked him to come next day. Next day, where is the sugar? Lump of salt, not sugar, salt. Lump of salt was brought and he put in water and asked the boy to come next day. Next day the boy came and where is that salt piece? The salt piece. It's not there. It's not visible now. The previous day he had seen that salt with his eyes. Now it is not invisible. Does it mean that there is no salt? No. It means there is salt there. You taste it, so the salt is there. Similarly, when you cannot fully understand certain things, there are other ways of knowing it. So you take the help of an instructor. It's an acharya. So acharya vadesha. And this significance is brought in this illustration. That's it. This is the 14th khanda. The other one is 13th verse khanda. Total are 16 khandas in the 6th chapter.
You mentioned God's grace. I sometimes get confused about God's grace and karma. Yeah. And it seems like karma is a law that can't be broken.
Yeah.
And yet we have God's grace.
Yes.
Can you distinguish this?
Yes. Now, you know, karma doesn't mean predetermination. In that case, if karma meant predetermination, there is no place for God or human effort. So there is an interesting description of the comparative relevance of human action, human will, and also God's grace. Suppose you are destined to be bitten by a snake. If you pray to God or if you do some good actions and meritorious actions, the intensity of what you are destined to suffer will be reduced. You may be bitten by an ant instead of a cobra. Now, In the Vedanta, when you read these books, you come across the Prarabdha, Sanchita Karma, Prarabdha Karma, and Agamya Karma. I should explain this. Sometimes, in some books you find, whatever has caused this body to be born, whatever is responsible, whatever karmas are responsible for your present predicament, you have to bear, there is no way out. But even in that case, it's not that you are destined to suffer or enjoy. No. Your effort can always change. How if this happens? So the example is given. Your previous karmas which determine your present predicament is like an arrow that has left the bow. So it has reached its goal, its mark. So it's flying. So you cannot stop its velocity because the archer has shot the arrow and the arrow has left the bow. But suppose a strong wind blows during the flight. It may lose its velocity or it may not hit the mark with great force. Similarly, whatever may be you are destined to suffer or enjoy will be modified. Its intensity could be reduced or increased by your own effort in the form of prayer, spiritual practice, etc. So karma is not an absolute deciding principle in Vedanta. It is a very serious misunderstanding. It is very widespread, very much prevalent all over the world, including India. People sometimes interpret karma as an omnipotent, as a powerful, predetermining factor. If a person ever thinks that whatever he is destined to suffer, he has to suffer, then he has no right to believe in God or to do any spiritual practice. Then why should you do anything? If our life is like a machine that you are programmed to function in a particular way, like a computer, you are programmed, it has to function in a particular predetermined way. If human life is like that, then there is no place for spirituality, spiritual practice, or metaphysics, or mysticism, anything. It's totally wrong. Karma is not an absolute or determining principle. Karma is only an attempt to explain the relationship between one action and its result. One action and another action. But then, if your present predicament is the result of your previous action, then your future can be the result of your present action. So you can change it, certainly. You can change it. Even your previous action, its intensity, its karma, that karma, also need not take effect, even if you practice today. So karma is not a tyrant. It's a very widespread misunderstanding, misinterpretation of karma as a predetermination. No. That is the very antithesis of karma. Karma liberates you from the tyranny because you can change your future, your destiny by good actions, good deeds. Any day, any time you can start a new life. Any moment. That's the greatness of karma doctrine. But sometimes it is interpreted, very wrongly interpreted as a cold, inflexible, rigid, predetermined factor. It's totally wrong. Okay. So we'll conclude now? Okay. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Sat Sri Ram Shmar Paramastu.